So a month before I graduated, I bought the house. It was the tail end of the recession. Right? So this house had been vacant for like 2 years. It was a short sale, super common at that time. And essentially house hacked it. We added value to it, you know, fixed it up. And then over the course of, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, it tripled in value. And we kind of rolled that into the next house. Also, my goal at that time, after reading, I think one of the Gary Keller books, was to buy 2 rentals per year. And so about a year and a half after I bought my primary residence, I bought my first rental. Similar thing, was a short sale. We added value to it, put some renters in there. And then literally every time a renter moved out, I had to bump up, you know, the rents by $200 or $300 just to keep up with market.
Welcome to the Physicians and Properties Podcast, the show where we teach you how investing in real estate can give you the freedom to practice medicine and live life how you want.
Doctor.
Now, here's your host, Dr. Alex Schlow.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Physicians and Properties Podcast. I am so glad that you're here. Today, I got to interview one of my friends, Dr. Ryan Sackstetter. He's an optometrist in Florida, and he is crushing it in real estate. Ryan graduated from optometry school in 2012. He worked in retail, in the retail environment, for about 10 months or so, and then he joined a large ophthalmology optometry practice, and he's been with them for the last 10 years. In that time span, he bought his first property, which was a short sale house hack that he renovated and actually tripled in value in a short time period. Then he bought another investment property, and then he started a wholesale and flipping company in which he's wholesaling and flipping different homes and keeping some of those as rentals. And now he's also gotten into ground-up construction. We talk a lot about ground-up construction in this episode, which is really cool because it's something we haven't talked about too much. And he's also launched a title company, which is really cool and really interesting to talk about vertical integration and how all these different businesses, all these different touch points go into just one transaction for real estate. So how can you get paid not only from the investment property, or if you're a real estate agent, get paid that commission, how can you get paid throughout the process multiple different ways, and how important vertical integration is. Ryan is just absolutely crushing it in everything he does. He's also a great husband and a great dad, and this episode is amazing. So go ahead, give this episode a listen. Let me know what you think. If you learned something, please feel free to give us a 5-star rating and a short review if you don't mind. Without any further ado, let's get started with today's episode with my friend Ryan. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Physicians and Properties Podcast. So excited for this episode with my friend, Dr. Ryan Sackstetter. Ryan, how you doing?
Doing great, Alex. I appreciate you having me on here.
Awesome, man. Oh, I'm excited. This is your first podcast.
It is. Yes, it is. You know, I applaud your mission. I think it's so cool what you're doing with this podcast, and also appreciate your military service, man. So thank you for having me on.
Thanks, man. My pleasure. Really, really appreciate it. And thank you for waking up early on a Sunday morning to get this done. It's going to be a great conversation with a lot of value, I'm sure.
Appreciate it. Yeah, I'm excited.
Awesome, man. Well, do you mind just telling the audience a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm an optometrist. I have been practicing for about 10 years now. I got out of school and, you know, did the retail environment. I worked for a big box store for about 10 months. I was fortunate enough to be recruited to an ophthalmology optometry referral center. I've been with them since. It's kind of the medical optometry that I enjoy doing. So I'm really lucky to be there. It's one of the biggest referral centers in the area. And that's my medical journey.
That's awesome. Where are you located, Ryan?
Yeah, in Tampa, Florida, St. Petersburg area.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah.
What's a day in the life of a medical optometrist? What's that look like for you?
Yeah, it's got a good amount of variety. We see a heavy patient load. It could be anything from kind of your routine refractions, glasses and contacts, to post-operative care. We have several cataract surgeons, glaucoma surgeons, retina surgeons. So we get to see the whole gamut, and then emergencies coming in, anything, any kind of crazy red eye, foreign body, you name it, we get to see it. We're kind of I think of ourselves as kind of like the quarterback or the primary care physician of the ophthalmology or optometry clinic. So anything comes in, we're kind of first line to see it, and then we triage accordingly.
That's awesome. Yeah. I don't know why, for me, for some reason, I don't mind blood, of course, vomit, any bodily fluids, but for some reason, the eye just kind of grosses me out a little bit. I mean, of course, it's absolutely amazing and incredible, but for some reason, I don't know, foreign bodies, those sorts of things. Saw a couple like globe traumas, and in med school that I'll never forget. And I don't know why, something about it.
some people are like that, and I totally get it. You know, for me, it's my world right now. So yeah, I enjoy it very much.
Yeah, it's a good world to be in. Well, that's awesome, man. And I'm sure that variability that you have with day to day is really helpful, you know, keeping you motivated.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's cool. How many patients do you typically see in a day, roughly?
Yeah, probably 25, 26 on a given day. It's fairly busy. That's with just one technician. So myself and a technician working that up throughout the day. Some days it's busy just because the complexity of the cases can kind of, you know, put you on your toes, but it's good.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. That's a busy day for sure. Awesome. Well, how did you get started investing in real estate?
Yeah, for me, I don't know. I always kind of had that bug. I guess, you know, it started back when I was 19 or 20. I read that purple book, the Rich Dad Poor Dad book, and that kind of started me on my journey as most people as well. But then I was kind of stuck in, I guess, analysis paralysis for 15, 20 years. You know, I was reading books and not really taking action. And then a month before I graduated optometry school, which was up in Chicago, I bought my first primary residence down in Florida. So a month before I graduated, I bought the house. It was the tail end of the recession. Right? So this house had been vacant for like 2 years. It was a short sale, super common at that time. And essentially house hacked it. We added value to it, you know, fixed it up. And then over the course of, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, it tripled in value. And we kind of rolled that into the next house. Also, my goal at that time, after reading, I think one of the Gary Keller books, was to buy 2 rentals per year. And so about a year and a half after I bought my primary residence, I bought my first rental. Similar thing, was a short sale. We added value to it, put some renters in there. And then literally every time a renter moved out, I had to bump up, you know, the rents by $200 or $300 just to keep up with market. Because Florida, over the past 10 years in our area in particular, has just been, just like the rest of the world, appreciating like crazy. Life got busy and I had a couple kids and things like that. So I didn't execute that plan of two per year. But a few years ago, you know, my kids got stable enough to where I felt comfortable jumping back into real estate. So I actually started a wholesale company. So I started a wholesale company, start doing direct to seller, you know, marketing, built a small team. That transitioned into flipping houses at the same time. Been doing that for a couple of years. And then last year launched a title company and then transitioning away from flips to ground up construction and a lot of commercial assets. So we've been looking at, you know, apartments, hotels, ALFs, which you and I have talked about in the past, and storage units.
That's awesome. You're crushing it.
Not yet. Trying to get there. You know, the things,
well, that's awesome.
They kind of build on themselves, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, going back to that first home that you bought, the short sale, the house that was vacant in Florida, what was that like? Or like kind of what was your mindset like? Were you pretty anxious about getting started, house hacking, buying a vacant house? And what's a short sale for folks who aren't interested or folks who don't know? Sorry.
Yeah, sure. So a short sale is essentially, it's not quite a bank owned property, but the value of the property has dropped below the mortgage. So at that time in the recession, a lot of home values just plummeted. And so these homes were worth less than the mortgage amount. So banks had 2 choices. They could either foreclose, which they would then lose money, or they could accept a short sale, which means that they were willing to sell it at a price that was less than the mortgage. It was a lot of paperwork at the time. It was a lot of, typically took like 2 to 4 months for a bank to decide that they were approving a short sale. And so there was a lot that went into it for that. But as far as being anxious, no, I was actually excited. I always knew home ownership was for me and real estate was interesting for me. And so it was finally kind of taking action and in doing it, you know, just like doing anything, you're able to learn a lot. So I learned about, you know, construction and lending and all of these things, you know, even home ownership, just taxes and insurance and paying all that stuff. So I learned a lot from it.
That's awesome. Were you able to get a mortgage on that short sale the same way you would if you were just buying a house that wasn't a short sale or a foreclosure?
Yes, you are. Now, it's interesting because for me, the story was a little bit different. I was in optometry school, so I had 0 income. And at the time, the lending environment had just changed. And so it went from being very loose where there was no doc loans to being very, very strict. And so for me, which I didn't realize until later, I actually had an extended family member in the mortgage industry. She was a mortgage broker and she was able to get an interest only loan for me. So I bought that first house interest only. And I think my payment was $750 a month, interest only. Yeah. And once I realized, after it closed and we were in it, and once I realized that it was interest only, I realized I was essentially renting this thing. So I quickly tried to refinance it. And so I refinanced into a traditional mortgage. Yeah. So.
Nice. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. $750 mortgage payment would be welcome now for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's interesting because when I refied, my payment went down. My principal payment on that first house was $541 a month. And for Florida, that's just unbelievable. And then, you know, I had to pay my taxes and insurance, but they were, you know, a minimal, probably a couple grand a year. So if, for me, it taught me something really valuable about the cost of living. And if I was able to live for less, then I could utilize my money elsewhere. And so I was able to have, you know, great experiences, you know, got a chance to backpack through Europe and things like that, that I probably wouldn't have otherwise been if I was over leveraged. So it taught me that early on.
That's awesome. Where was your favorite place you backpacked through Europe?
Oh, I think Prague. Prague was probably the most beautiful city that I've seen in Europe. It was really awesome there. I had a chance to go to Venice as well, which is a completely unique, you know, city in itself, just surrounded by water. But the whole European experience was really amazing. So I'm excited to go back in the future at some point. But yeah, I think Prague was up there.
That's awesome. Yeah, my brother and I, right after I took step one, the first part of the board exam in med school, it was brutal. And we had, I think, like three weeks after off, which was awesome. And so we backpacked through Europe. We did a little less than 3 weeks, and we went to Iceland, London, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, and Budapest. Back to London, then back to Iceland. And it was a crazy busy trip, but man, it was just so much fun. We loved Prague though. The food was amazing. We found this like little hole in the wall restaurant that someone recommended. And I was trying to think about what the dish was that we had, but it was kind of like a dumpling and some meat. And it was so good. We ended up just going back there every night, the next couple of nights that we were there, and didn't try anything else out. Cause we're like, there's nothing that's going to beat this.
that's awesome. That's so fun, man. I mean, that's what life's about. You know, it's about experiences and being able to do things like that, experience cultures and other food. It's awesome.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, and I think the important thing that you hit on was you didn't have that lifestyle creep, you know, graduated optometry school or graduated medical school and got a residency. And then, you know, income goes up dramatically and you're buying the new Tesla, you know, you're buying a house and that house hack and fix up to add value. And then you're going, you know, backpacking through Europe. And I think those experiences are so much more important. And I personally am, you know, definitely the fan of avoiding lifestyle creep as long as possible, living like a resident as long as possible, and then having the opportunity to do these incredible experiences and get these investments that are going to set you up in the future for sure.
Absolutely, for sure, man. It's funny you say that because I had the worst car in the whole parking lot when I started. I mean, all these other positions had, their Mercedes and their Porsches or whatever. So I had this old Honda that I was still driving, and it was definitely the worst car, but it gave me the opportunity, like you said, to do that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I told this story on the podcast before, but the clinic that I'm at, there was another PA and two nurse practitioners and myself here in Colorado. And the PA was driving like this 2009 Honda Civic that had the back bumper duct taped to keep it held up. The other one was driving this really old hail damaged Mazda hatchback car that I don't even think they make anymore. And then another one was driving an old Cherokee. And I was driving, and still am, a 2012 Volkswagen Jetta that's hail damaged. And then the pharmacy tech pulls up in one of those brand new Teslas that has like the Lamborghini doors that open up.
Yes.
And you're like, this is hilarious that all the providers in the clinic are driving the crappiest car. It's a good example and a good reminder there.
That's too funny. Yeah. I mean, to this day, there are some of the technicians that have nicer vehicles than myself. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the way it should be though, I think.
Yeah.
which is awesome. Well, cool. Yeah. So after that first one, buying the next one, what was that like, getting the next short sale, the next investment property for you?
Yeah. So bought that rental property, went in and fixed it up, got some tenants in there. We had to put a new roof on it, new AC, just the stuff like that. And I still own it today. And it's honestly been a great investment for us. I mean, we've been able to capture the appreciation. It's helped a lot with tax benefits. You know, I self-manage, which also taught me a lot. I mean, I don't have any short-term rentals. I do all long-term rentals. And it's just been invaluable for me to have that insight on kind of how it operates and things like that. It can be busy certain times, you know, when one tenant moves out or we're getting ready to lease it to the new one, that's when it's the busiest. But after that, I found it's pretty much, you know, kind of set it and forget it. built a nice little team of kind of handyman electricians and plumbers. And if there's ever an emergency, you know, I call. I'm not heading out there to do any toilets or anything like that. We've had our share of plumbing issues, but I'm not the one handling them, which is nice. And then when I get to the point where I need to bring in a management company, you know, I'll be able to have that experience to kind of know what to look for.
That's awesome. Do you feel like you're getting close to that point, or it's manageable for you at this point?
Yeah, it's still manageable. I mean, we only have a handful of rentals right now. And so I do think it's still manageable. I think when you hit a certain threshold, I don't know what it is yet, but then it becomes probably too cumbersome to self-manage. But no, I think I'm still in a point where I can handle.
That's good. Any specific like systems or recommendations you'd have for someone who wants to manage on their own? And I think it's a great thing to do because you're getting that is that hands-on education of, hey, this is what goes into property management. So then when you're looking for a property manager, you know, hey, these are things I really need to look into. So you got any tips or any systems that you like to use?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it all starts on the front end. I mean, if you bring in a quality tenant, then it makes your life so much easier. And so all the rentals that I own are renovated. So it brings in a higher premium, and it also brings in a little bit higher tenant base. Someone who's not going to destroy the house per se. And I kind of like that niche. But I spend a lot of time up front selecting the right tenant. It starts with the first communication. So you put the listing up. I typically use Zillow. They respond and I send them just an automated email that says, hey, you know, I'm the property manager for this. I want to ask you a few questions if you don't mind. And it's basically like, hey, do you have any bankruptcies? How many people are in your family that are going to live there? Do you have any pets or have been evicted? So it just eliminates right off the bat, probably, you know, half the tenants that could potentially not be good tenants. And then I like to be there for the showings as well. So I get to meet the people. And of course, we follow all the kind of equal opportunity, fair housing laws. You know, there's no discrimination. But I think that when you meet someone kind of in person, you really get a good feel for them. And so we still take, you know, the first qualified tenant, but at least you're able to kind of see who is in the pool. I also like to do just obviously because I'm busy and because it's beneficial, but I do group showings. So I say, hey, our first available showing is going to be this Saturday at 2 p.m. Can you make it? And that way, pretty much all the tenant pools or all the applicants come right at that point in time. They get to a little bit of a, like a feeding frenzy. They get a little bit of kind of the not wanting to miss out, fear of missing out. And also I get to just get everybody in at once. And so that's been beneficial too.
That's awesome. Yeah. I haven't really heard of that, but that makes a whole lot of sense to do it that way. And then you're saving, you know, your time of running back and forth. That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. And then on the back end, I set up all payments automatically. I started out using a company called Cozy.co. They got bought out by Apartments.com. And so everything goes through Apartments.com. I handmade my lease initially, you know, 10 years ago from a culmination of a bunch of different leases. And it's probably, boy, I don't know, 20 pages long. It's super in-depth, but I also feel like that covers me really, really well. And again, just trying to keep a good tenant base in there.
That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah. I think you hit the key point. It starts with a good tenant. Getting a good tenant in there is going to make your life so much easier, and making sure you're providing like a good property that's not going to constantly need repairs is super important too. Those are the two biggest keys, I think, if you want to do it yourself. That's awesome.
Yeah. And then on the flip side, you know, our job as landlords is to provide good quality housing. So if something pops up, like I'm going to be responsive, I want to get taken care of, not like for the property's sake, but for the tenant's sake. And I think that that's a good kind of mutual relationship, and it's been helped me along the way as well.
Yeah. And well, it keeps folks wanting to stay there for longer too. I remember I was renting this apartment out in Richmond. My buddy and I were splitting the rent, and there was a leak in the living room. It probably took like 2 or 3 months for someone to come out here and finally fix this leak. And by that time, there was a bunch of drywall that was damaged. I mean, the repair was way more extensive than it would have been if they just came out within a couple of days of us reaching out to them. But, you know, and it was frustrating for us too, because here we have like drywall crumbling and soggy and falling onto the couch and all this stuff. And so it was a mess. So I think just it's easy to take care of your tenants well. And part of that, just showing up early and getting things done.
Yeah, absolutely. No, valid point. Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome. So pivoted a little bit after that, it sounds like, into wholesaling. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. So I jumped in at that point and thought, you know, hey, wholesaling sounds like a cool thing for me. At the time, it was very popular a few years back, and got educated on it and just started doing it. So just started marketing. At the beginning, I was wearing all the hats, you know, I was taking the phone calls. I was going to see potential sellers and homeowners and having those conversations. And it's neat because I actually learned that there's a lot of parallels between, you know, medicine and talking to a homeowner or a person in need. And it's just, you know, listening, providing a solution, you know, saying, hey, what's your problem today? Here are the potential diagnoses. Here's the potential treatments. Same thing with the sellers. Like, hey, what do you need? What's going on in your world? What has you wanting to sell? And then providing some solutions based on that. And that could be, you know, just a straight cash purchase. It could be seller financing. It could be subject to. So all those things are kind of really neat avenues or tools that you can offer someone. But medicine and being a physician is not too far off from, you know, being in real estate.
That's awesome. Yeah. If folks aren't familiar with wholesaling, do you mind kind of describing what wholesaling is?
Sure. Yeah. So wholesaling is essentially just direct to seller marketing. You would go to homeowner potentially responds to like a letter that we sent out that says, hey, I'm interested in selling my house. Great. Let's come together. Let's find a price that works for both of us. A wholesaler will offer convenience. So a cash price, no showings, don't have to do any renovations, and potentially speed or really closing on their timeline. And then the wholesaler will then sell that contract. So they get the house under contract and they can sell that contract to an end buyer, typically a landlord or a flipper who's going to come in and do what they need to. So the wholesaler is kind of the middleman and they make an assignment fee or a profit based on just selling that contract. The beauty of wholesaling is it's typically low cost. You're not having to close on the house. You're not having to do the renovations. You're really just providing value and marketing and then getting that contract assigned.
That's awesome. What did the wholesale business look like for you? Was it pretty profitable?
You know, it was variable. It had its ups and downs. The first year was pretty good. Then I built a small team. I had some overseas virtual assistants that were doing some cold calling. I brought in an acquisitions person because I realized pretty quickly that I was the bottleneck of the company. I mean, I had my W-2 job. Plus, I'm trying to go meet sellers, and time is of the essence sometimes. And if you can't get out there right away, then you're losing contracts. So I brought on the acquisitions person to focus solely on that. And then I've tried pretty much every kind of marketing that they have for wholesaling. I test and pivot. That's kind of what I like to do. And then as my flipping business got busier, I kind of neglected the wholesaling business a little bit. And long story short, I recently kind of joined forces with another wholesaler just to partner up and kind of take some of that load off. But we're ramping back up again with the wholesaling side of things.
Awesome. Were you guys taking the deals from wholesaling, taking some of those and using those for flips, or were the flips different deals that you were finding?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that was one of my problems is I was cherry picking too many deals. So instead of, you know, selling them for the assignment fee, I was looking at the spreads and I was like, hey, I can either make, you know, $10,000 on an assignment fee or I can make $450,000 on a flip. And so that's what attracted me to it. And then on top of that, I ended up keeping a lot of them as rentals. And so that doesn't help the wholesaling business because it's a very cash heavy wholesale business when you're doing kind of consistent marketing. And if you're not feeding that marketing budget and you're just keeping everything, then it kind of is, you know, a cycle that doesn't work too well. But yeah, to answer your question, we were getting some of the flips from there and some of the rentals too.
That's awesome. Yeah. What's a typical flip look like, or what did a flip look like for you at the time?
Yeah. So pretty cosmetic flips. We would do flooring. We do kitchens, bathrooms, a couple of roofs. I tried to stay away from anything where you're kind of tearing out walls or redoing structure, but we have had a couple of those. For me, you know, flipping was very, very active. And, you know, I had all the systems in place to have our contractors picking up material and hiring their own subs and things like that. But you're still doing, you know, site visits multiple times a week. There's always an emergency that comes up, or you have to run to Home Depot and get something last minute. And that was one of the big reasons that I transitioned out of these very active flips to the ground up construction.
Nice. Awesome. Yeah. Ground up construction. Super interesting. We haven't, I think you and I talked about it briefly. We, of course, are buying the assisted living homes, and we've been thinking a lot about, man, this would maybe be easier just to go ground up and then, you know, buy a big plot of land and maybe build a couple homes on it, or one assisted living home and then one memory care home where folks are just transitioning from one to the other, and build that house exactly as we want it. But I'll be honest, I don't know a whole lot about ground up construction and land development or anything like that. Do you mind, or would you be willing to kind of share some of your experience and kind of tips and tricks in terms of ground up construction?
Yeah, 100%. So ground up construction is neat because it's just a math equation. And one of the things that I really like about it is it's much less active than the flips. There's no surprises. You know, when you're flipping a house, you open a wall and then all of a sudden, hey, there's $10,000 worth of termite damage. So with ground up construction, you identify a piece of land, you identify what you could sell it for at the end, you find a good builder, and then it's just have them execute the plans. And so that's a very much less hands-off. I mean, there's a little bit more work to it than that, but there's kind of a rule of thumb, a 1/5 or 20% of the ARV, what you're going to sell the house for, and that's what you should be spending on your land. So for example, we've got one now that we purchased the land for $100,000. Our build cost is about $150 a square foot on it. So if we were building like a bread and butter 1500 square foot house, we've got about $225,000 build or vertical cost. There's some other ancillary costs with that. So you've got your, what we call horizontals, your permits, your plans, things like that, or your money costs. So if you get $225 in the build, you've got maybe $25,000 ancillaries, that's $250. And then you got your land costs, which is $100, so that's $350,000. That house in our area will sell for like $500,000. So your spreads are pretty good. So most builders, but many builders target a six-figure profit because the revenue cycle of it is a little bit longer. I mean, you're talking about 12 to 18 months. But the neat thing with ground-up construction is your return on investment is pretty high. The lenders like it if you can buy the land. So if you're in it for $100,000, and you've got this draw process where you've got to pay for construction up front and then you draw it back. So if you get like $100,000 or $150,000 into one of these projects, you can make $100,000 in, you know, 12 to 18 months. It's basically a 66% cash on cash return. And then as you start to build up that pile, then you can do two at once, three at once, four at once. Obviously, you can see the money multiplier. A cool kind of twist on that as well is if you aren't using all of your own money and you bring in maybe some private money on the front end, then your cash on cash return skyrockets. Your actual net profit will go down a little bit because now you're paying some financing fees and some lender fees, but your returns go from like 66% cash on cash return to like 200, 500% cash on cash returns, or even infinite if you have no money in it. Yeah. So it has a lot of perks. I really enjoy the mathematics of it, just the analyzing the deals and finding them and then just executing them, for me is a lot easier than the active flips.
Man, that's awesome. Thanks for that. Are you guys pretty much focused just in Florida for ground up construction, or are you building somewhere else?
Yeah, I've got a cul-de-sac in Nashville, Tennessee that we're doing five units on, and then the rest are here in Florida. Yeah.
That's awesome. How do you fund it up front? Is it all private money at this point for you? Are you able to get construction financing, or what's that look like?
Yeah, we do a combination. So right now for this one, for example, we just bought for $100,000 the lot. It was private money on the front end. And then we're going to bring in a lender who's going to refi out that private money lender and fund the construction. Okay. So for us, that way we have very little money in it and be a little bit higher, you know, returns on it.
Nice. What's typically the timeline, Ryan, for like acquiring the land, closing on the land, and shoveling the dirt, getting started on the build?
It depends on the area. There's different municipalities that are slower than others. It depends on your builder as well. If they've kind of got a pre-approved plan, that really helps. There's also modular homes that we've been exploring as well. And that's basically homes that are built in a factory and they are starting on those homes while you're in the permitting process, so that when you get the permits approved, you're ready to basically just lay it down and go. And that can certainly speed up your timeline. But to answer your question, it's probably about 3 months for that permitting process in general, sometimes less, some municipalities more. But yeah, that's probably on average what we've been seeing.
Nice. Any tips for finding a good builder?
Yeah, same as with like contractors. Asking around, referrals are huge, and then interviewing. I mean, the past 2 weeks, we've actually interviewed 5 builders for this project and just kind of get an idea of, you know, how they operate. What's their projected timeline on the build? How do they handle the draws? How do they handle the permitting process? You know, things like that, that are super helpful. And then really, what do some of the projects look like? What do their finishes look like? Because at the end of the day, if they can turn one out really fast, but it's really poor quality, then it's just going to sit for longer.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you guys planning to sell the homes or keep them as rentals?
Yeah. This one here, the 5 units in Nashville, we're going to sell at least 3 and then reevaluate the last 2. We'd like to keep at least 1 on that, depending on where the profits fall. This one here in St. Petersburg has the city's allowing an ADU, an auxiliary dwelling unit, on this particular lot. So we're going to build a main house and an auxiliary dwelling unit, an ADU on it, and we can rent out both. So for us, this is a build to rent. The area that we purchased it in is appreciating in value. It's kind of a focus for the city as far as development. So we think that the value will increase over the next kind of 3 to 5 years. So for us, this is a perfect build to rent situation. But I would say the most of what we target is going to be build to sell.
That's awesome. Well, super cool. Yeah. And the ADU, you know, discussion, I don't know why other municipalities are like, for example, here in Colorado Springs, like we need more housing desperately. And I don't know why they're not approving ADUs. I think it's something to come, but hopefully, you know, hopefully they do, because I'll be putting one in my backyard immediately and start
there. You go. Out too. Absolutely, man. Absolutely. Yeah. There's a huge need for, you know, affordable and workforce housing in a lot of areas. And our area is one of those. And so luckily our city and the county were willing to open up certain areas for that. And we just happened to find one in that area.
That's awesome. This might be a silly question, but if you're building a home on the plot of land, for example, with the builder, are you signing like, hey, are you signing a contract that's basically saying like you're going to build the house for $300,000, or is it kind of fluctuating over time since, you know, cost of labor might go up or supplies might go up or something like that? Is there a range, or what does that look like?
Yeah, it's an agreed upon price up front. Every builder's a little bit different. Some will do, here's the plan, here's the price. Some will say, here's our price per square foot. You can go to an engineer and architect to build the plan and we'll build it. Some will do cost plus, which essentially means it's their cost to build it plus their profit. It can be anywhere from 10 to 20% that the builder takes. So you do see a variety in that. And because of that, you also see a variety in kind of a build price per square foot. I mean, some builders can build as cheap as like $90 a square foot. Some will go up to, you know, 150 square foot is kind of more what we're finding in our area. And then the higher end homes have higher finishes. So your cost per square foot obviously goes up. The neat thing with the higher end homes is the profit also goes up. So on these, you know, kind of quote unquote bread and butter houses that we have, 1500 square feet, 3 2s, you know, you're looking at about $100,000 profit per build. But I know one of the investors in the area, his profit is more like $500,000 per turn, and he's building $1.5 million homes. And then there's one investor in particular in our area that's building waterfront luxury homes, and she buys the land for $1 million. She'll build for $1.5 million. So she's all in for $2.5 million, and she sells it for between $3.5 and $4 million. Wow. So she profits, you know, $1 to $1.5 million on average. The one that she's finishing up right now, she's projecting a $2.1 million net profit. Yeah. And she does basically one of these a year. And that's it. I mean, you can see that just doing one project can really, you know, replace your income, for example. Or, you know, even when you compare these bread and butter houses that we're doing that are profiting $100,000, you know, doesn't take many of those to replace, you know, a lot of people's income. You could do, you know, one a year. You could do 2 a year. You could do 1 a quarter. It really just comes down to what you want to accomplish. And so when comparing that to kind of the speed of the revenue cycle of the other businesses, you know, wholesaling, you're getting as little clicks of money, but it's very quick, 15 to 30 days. And then with flipping, it's more like 3 to 6 months. You're doing anywhere from, you know, 20 to 50,000. And then with these new builds, you know, it's 100,000 plus. So you could kind of compare 4 flips to 1 new build in the same amount of time. And it's much less activity or active hands-on with it.
Yeah. are you still doing some of those other, you know, are you still wholesaling, flipping, et cetera, right now? Or are you pretty much focused just on ground up construction?
Yeah, we still have the wholesaling company running. I had mentioned that we're kind of gearing that up a little bit more as well. It's because for me, that's a great opportunity to get more rentals. I like to kind of cherry pick those rentals. It's also got to the point where it's a little bit more hands-off for me so I can focus on some of the other stuff. So I still got the acquisitions person. I just partnered with another person, another partner to handle a lot of the wholesaling stuff. I have a few active flips going on right now with partners that I'm very hands-off with, but I am segueing away from the flips now and just doing new builds.
Nice. That's awesome. And then you guys just launched a title company, right?
Yes. Yeah. Last year, launched a title company. That's been a really cool experience and you know, obviously a huge learning curve. So, but it's been neat.
That's cool. What's the name of the title company in case folks are in Florida looking for a good one?
Yeah, it's Titan Title, T-I-T-A-N, Titan Title. A partner and I launched it 2023. We're both obviously active in real estate and we kind of found a need for it. There's a lot of title companies, but not all title companies know how to handle, you know, some of the investor files and more intricate files. So we found a need in our area and decided to launch it. We had a mentor, his name is Kyle Robinson, and he's a very successful real estate broker, I think up in Iowa, and he's got a huge team, but he also has about 12 companies that he runs because he taught us about vertical integration. He said that on any typical real estate transaction, there's anywhere from 15 to 20 parties involved touching that transaction. You're talking about, you know, your survey company, your title company, the underwriters, the appraisal, the mortgage broker, the everybody that's just involved. So he said that if I'm going to do a real estate transaction, why would I get paid just once as a real estate agent? Why not try to capture more of that? And so that really taught us about vertical integration. And so our objective with this was to not only provide, you know, this stellar title company that can handle a lot of stuff and provide, you know, great customer service, but also to kind of capture some of that additional revenue as well.
That's awesome. Yeah. And of course you need it for the wholesaling business, the flipping business, the ground up construction. I mean, it's just perfectly vertically integrated. Is there exactly. Another business you're targeting next or another, you know, pathway in the vertical integration pathway that you want to get after?
Yeah. The mortgage industry. So bringing on a mortgage broker and opening a mortgage company makes a lot of sense as well. You know, if an agent brings you a file, there's often nice to have just everything in-house. Hey, we'll do your title. We'll provide your loan as well. It's a similar business to the title industry, just in its structure. So that is probably next in line.
Very cool. That's awesome. How does a title company make money?
Yeah, great question. So title companies make money two ways. They charge a settlement fee, which is basically the fee for doing their service. And they also get paid a revenue of the owner's title policy. So there are underwriters that underwrite it. They collect the title policy and then they give back the title company a portion of that title policy. And it's state specific. So every state is different about what that amount is or how much is allocated. In Florida, it's a set rate. So you know going into it what your projected profit is on any given transaction because it's based on the price of the home and what that underwriting policy will be.
Nice. That's awesome. Ryan, you're crushing it, man. How do you have time to do all this in real estate, be a dad, optometrist, all the above? What are some tips and tricks you have for that?
Yeah, it's about structure and balance. And I tell people I live in the gaps a lot of times. So I'm doing things, you know, first thing in the morning before the kids are up, I do things on my lunch breaks. You know, sometimes there are time in between patients where I can make a quick phone call. It's not very often now with how busy we are, but just utilizing that time after the kids go down for bed, I'm usually doing a Zoom call if I need to. Things like that. You know, I try to structure my day to where I'm up early and I get my exercise in, which is kind of my me time and my health time. And then getting the kids ready for school. And then when I pick the kids up from school, I put my phone down and I just have that dedicated kind of dad time with them. And then as soon as they're in bed, I'm picking it back up. So yeah, that's it's just a balance game.
Yeah, absolutely. Same way on my end as well. I like hearing how folks are doing it and learning different tips and tricks. And, you know, family for me is most important, you know, and so I'm always trying to figure out, well, how can I be a better dad, more present dad, those sorts of things. And it sounds very similar for you as well.
Yeah, 100%. You know, the end goal for all of us is kind of this financial freedom, geographic freedom, yep. philanthropic freedom. And so we do these things for our kids and our family and for the experiences in life. And so it's important to keep that in perspective. I'm guilty of sometimes forgetting, like, hey, you know, you're really busy, but what is the goal? What is the objective? And it's for these kids and this family time.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what's next for you?
We're just ramping up the commercial asset side of things. We've been analyzing a lot of deals and putting in lots of offers to get something on that end. And then the new builds, we're ramping up the title company. We just had our 2024 annual meeting and just getting things ready to explode that. We're going to expand in Florida and keep pushing that forward.
That's awesome, man. Is there anything we haven't hit on or any pieces of advice you'd give to someone just getting started?
Nothing we have hit on. There are three things that I would really recommend anybody who's getting started. The first one is just take action. And one of my mentors said, take massive action. So I think for me personally, I sat on the sideline for too long because I wanted to know everything and I wanted to be perfect before I jumped in. And taking that imperfect action kind of is the best way to get going. I think, you know, in medical school, we get a really good, solid education. But I think most people would agree that our true learning happens when it's hands-on, when we get into clinic and are doing all the things that we thought we were supposed to learn and realizing it's very different. I would say also kind of getting around the right people. I invest a lot kind of in myself. I'm part of a couple masterminds. And that network has just been invaluable. I mean, that network led me to you. Anytime I have a question about something I don't know, whether it's a hotel or an ALF, like I know there's people in my network that I can reach out to. And it's been great, you know, having that and being able to talk to people like you and just learning kind of your experience and also your knowledge, which helps kind of propel me forward. I would say that my success in real estate, and I don't think I'm successful yet, but it has a lot to do with just getting around those people. My growth really exploded when I started joining the masterminds and investing in myself in that way. And then the third thing I would say is, you know, give more than you take. And if you go into it with a mindset of just giving more than you take, it can just really propel you forward. I remember someone saying either in a book or a magazine that your net worth or your value is directly correlated with the number of people that you help. And so you see that with the Jeff Bezos of the world, with Amazon and Mark Zuckerberg with Facebook, you know, so many people in this world use those things. And so their value is very, very high. And that goes for physicians as well. I mean, we help people in a very different way. I mean, the doctors are saving lives and creating healthy lives for people. And so they get compensated accordingly. But yeah, the more you can help people, I think the more it comes back to you.
That was a perfect answer. That's awesome. Yeah, I completely agree. All the above. That's awesome, Ryan. Well, how can folks reach out to you if they want to know more or find out more about the title company or some other projects you guys are doing?
Yeah, shoot me a text. I mean, I'm an open book. I'll talk about anything. My number is 419-934-322. I put that out there. Hopefully you don't spam me, but I'm happy to just hop on a call, shoot me a text, and we'll set up a conversation. But yeah, I'm happy to give any way I can.
Awesome. Appreciate it. Well, I'm glad to have your number. I'll be reaching out to you too. And looking forward to seeing, you know, how much growth comes in 2024 for you, man.
Awesome, Alex. I appreciate it, man. Thanks again. Really appreciate you.
Absolutely. All right. Well, with that, it's been another episode of the Physicians and Properties Podcast. You got Dr. Alex Schlow and Dr. Ryan Stecksetter signing off. Hey, real quick, if you're still listening to this, I'm assuming you got value from it. So I need your help specifically. My 2-year vision with this podcast is to help 100,000 physicians learn how investing in real estate can give you the freedom to practice medicine and live life how you want. There are two main ways that a podcast grows. One is through ratings and reviews, and the other is word of mouth. If you can please leave me a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, as well as send this to 1 to 2 friends that you think would get value from it, we can reach the physicians that we want to reach. Thanks in advance, and talk to you on the next episode. Please note that the information shared on this podcast is for informational purposes only. It should not be considered financial or medical advice. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the host and the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Department of Defense or the United States Air Force.